The Blithedale Romance by Nathaniel Hawthorne. Chapter 15. A Crisis. Thus the summer was passing away, a summer of toil, of interest, of something that was not pleasure, but which went deep into my heart, and there became a rich experience. I found myself looking forward to years, if not to a lifetime, to be spent on the same system. The community were now beginning to form their permanent plans. One of our purposes was to erect a phalanstery, as I think we called it, after a foyer, but the phraseology of those days is not very fresh in my remembrance, where the great and general family should have its abiding place. Individual members, too, who made it a point of religion to preserve the sanctity of an exclusive home, were selecting sites for their cottages, by the woodside, or on the breezy swells, or in the sheltered nook of some little valley, according as their taste might lean towards snugness or the picturesque. Altogether, by projecting our minds outward, we had imparted a show of novelty to existence, and contemplated it as hopefully as if the soil beneath our feet had not been fathomed deep with the dust of deluded generations, on every one of which, as on ourselves, the world had imposed itself as a hitherto unwedded bride. Hollingsworth and myself had often discussed these prospects. It was easy to perceive, however, that he spoke with little or no fervor, but either as questioning the fulfillment of our anticipations, or, at any rate, with a quiet consciousness that it was no personal concern of his. Shortly after the scene at Eliot's pulpit, while he and I were repairing an old stone fence, I amused myself with sallying forward into the future time. "When we come to be old men," I said, "they will call us uncles or fathers, Father Hollingsworth and Uncle Coverdale, and we will look back cheerfully to these early days and make a romantic story for the young people, and, if a little more romantic than truth may warrant, it will be no harm, out of our severe trials and hardships. In a century or two, we shall every one of us be mythical personages, or exceedingly picturesque and poetical ones at all events. They will have a great public hall in which your portrait and mine and 20 other faces that are living now shall be hung up. And as for me, I will be painted in my shirt sleeves and with the sleeves rolled up to show my muscular development. What stories will be rife among them about our mighty strength," continued I, lifting a big stone and putting it into its place, "though our posterity will really be far stronger than ourselves. After several generations of a simple, natural, and active life, what legends of Zenobia's beauty and Priscilla's slender and shadowy grace and those mysterious qualities which make her seem diaphanous with spiritual light. In due course of ages we must all figure heroically in an epic poem, and we will ourselves, at least I will, bend unseen over the future poet and lend him inspiration while he writes it." "You seem," said Hollingsworth, "to be trying how much nonsense you could pour out in a breath." "I wish you would see fit to comprehend," retorted I, "that the profoundest wisdom must be mingled with 9/10 of nonsense, else it is not worth the breath that utters it. But I do long for the cottages to be built, that the creeping plants may begin to run over them, and the moss to gather on the walls, and the trees, which we will set out, to cover them with a breadth of shadow. This spick-and-span novelty does not quite suit my taste. It is time, too, for children to be born among us. The firstborn child is still to come, and I shall never feel as if this were a real, practical, as well as poetical system of human life until somebody has sanctified it by death." "A pretty occasion for martyrdom, truly," said Hollingsworth. "As good as any other," I replied. "I wonder, Hollingsworth, who of all these strong men and fair women and maidens is doomed the first to die? Would it not be well, even before we have absolute need of it, to fix upon a spot for a cemetery? Let us choose the rudest, roughest, most uncultivable spot for death's garden ground, and death shall teach us to beautify it, grave by grave. By our sweet, calm way of dying, and the airy elegance out of which we will shape our funeral rites, and the cheerful allegories which we will model into tombstones, the final scene shall lose its terrors, so that, hereafter, it may be happiness to live and bliss to die. None of us must die young, yet, should Providence ordain it so, the event shall not be sorrowful, but affect us with a tender, delicious, only half melancholy, and almost smiling pathos. That is to say, muttered Hollingsworth, you will die like a heathen, as you certainly live like one. But listen to me, Coverdale. Your fantastic anticipations make me discern all the more forcibly what a wretched, unsubstantial scheme is this on which we have wasted a precious summer of our lives. Do you seriously imagine that any such realities as you and many others here have dreamed of will ever be brought to pass? Certainly I do, said I. Of course, when the reality comes, it will wear the everyday, commonplace, dusty, and rather homely garb that reality always does put on. But setting aside the ideal charm, I hold that our highest anticipations have a solid footing on common sense. You only half believe what you say, rejoined Hollingsworth. And as for me, I neither have faith in your dream, nor would care the value of this pebble for its realization were that possible. And what more do you want of it? It has given you a theme for poetry. Let that content you. But now I ask you to be at last a man of sobriety and earnestness, and aid me in an enterprise which is worth all our strength, and the strength of a thousand mightier than we. There can be no need of giving in detail the conversation that ensued. It is enough to say that Hollingsworth once more brought forward his rigid and unconquerable idea, a scheme for the reformation of the wicked by methods moral, intellectual, and industrial, by the sympathy of pure, humble, and yet exalted minds, and by opening to his pupils the possibility of a worthier life than that which had become their fate. It appeared, unless he overestimated his own means, that Hollingsworth held it at his choice, and he did so choose, to obtain possession of the very ground on which we had planted our community, and which had not yet been made irrevocably ours, by purchase. It was just the foundation that he desired. Our beginnings might readily be adapted to his great end. The arrangements, already completed, would work quietly into his system. So plausible looked his theory, and more than that, so practical, such an air of reasonableness had he, by patient thought, thrown over it. Each segment of it was contrived to dovetail into all the rest with such a complicated applicability, and so ready was he with a response for every objection, that really, so far as logic and argument went, he had the matter all his own way. But, said I, whence can you, having no means of your own, derive the enormous capital which is essential to this experiment? State Street, I imagine, would not draw its purse strings very liberally in aid of such a speculation. I have the funds, as much at least as is needed for a commencement, at command, he answered. They can be produced within a month, if necessary. My thoughts reverted to Zenobia. It could only be her wealth which Hollingsworth was appropriating so lavishly. And on what conditions was it to be had? Did she fling it into the scheme with the uncalculating generosity that characterizes a woman when it is her impulse to be generous at all? And did she fling herself along with it? But Hollingsworth did not volunteer an explanation. And have you no regrets, I inquired, in overthrowing this fair system of our new life, which has been planned so deeply and is now beginning to flourish so hopefully around us? How beautiful it is, and so far as we can yet see, how practicable! The ages have awaited us, and here we are, the very first that have essayed to carry on our mortal existence in love and mutual help. Hollingsworth, I would be loath to take the ruin of this enterprise upon my conscience. Then let it rest wholly upon mine, he answered, knitting his black brows. I see through the system. It is full of defects, irremediable and damning ones. From first to last, there is nothing else. I grasp it in my hand and find no substance whatever. There is not human nature in it. Why are you so secret in your operations? I asked. God forbid that I should accuse you of intentional wrong, but the besetting sin of a philanthropist, it appears to me, is apt to be a moral obliquity. His sense of honor ceases to be the sense of other honorable men. At some point of his course, I know not exactly when nor where, he is tempted to palter with the right, and can scarcely forbear persuading himself that the importance of his public ends renders it allowable to throw aside his private conscience. Oh, my dear friend, beware this error. If you meditate the overthrow of this establishment, call together our companions, state your design, support it with all your eloquence, but allow them an opportunity of defending themselves. It does not suit me, said Hollingsworth, nor is it my duty to do so. I think it is, replied I. Hollingsworth frowned, not in passion, but, like fate, inexorably. "I will not argue the point," said he. "What I desire to know of you is, and you can tell me in one word, whether I am to look for your cooperation in this great scheme of good. Take it up with me. Be my brother in it. It offers you, what you have told me over and over again that you need most, a purpose in life worthy of the extremest self-devotion, worthy of martyrdom, should God so order it. In this view, I present it to you. You can greatly benefit mankind. Your peculiar faculties, as I shall direct them, are capable of being so wrought into this enterprise that not one of them need lie idle. Strike hands with me, and from this moment you shall never again feel the languor and vague wretchedness of an indolent or half-occupied man. There may be no more aimless beauty in your life, but in its stead there shall be strength, courage, immitigable will, everything that a manly and generous nature should desire. We shall succeed. We shall have done our best for this miserable world, and happiness, which never comes but incidentally, will come to us unawares." It seemed his intention to say no more, but after he had quite broken off, his deep eyes filled with tears, and he held out both his hands to me. "Coverdale," he murmured, "there is not the man in this wide world whom I can love as I could you. Do not forsake me." As I look back upon this scene, through the coldness and dimness of so many years, there was still a sensation as if Hollingsworth had caught hold of my heart and were pulling it towards him with an almost irresistible force. It is a mystery to me how I withstood it, but, in truth, I saw in his scheme of philanthropy nothing but what was odious, a loathsomeness that was to be forever in my daily work, a great black ugliness of sin which he proposed to collect out of 1,000 human hearts, and that we should spend our lives in an experiment of transmuting it into virtue. Had I but touched his extended hand, Hollingsworth's magnetism would perhaps have penetrated me with his own conception of all these matters. But I stood aloof. I fortified myself with doubts whether his strength of purpose had not been too gigantic for his integrity, impelling him to trample on considerations that should have been paramount to every other. "Is Zenobia to take a part in your enterprise?" I asked. "She is," said Hollingsworth. "She, the beautiful, the gorgeous," I exclaimed. "And how have you prevailed with such a woman to work in this squalid element?" "Through no base methods, as you seem to suspect," he answered, "but by addressing whatever is best and noblest in her." Hollingsworth was looking on the ground, but as he often did so, generally, indeed, in his habitual moods of thought, I could not judge whether it was from any special unwillingness now to meet my eyes. What it was that dictated my next question, I cannot precisely say. Nevertheless, it rose so inevitably into my mouth, and, as it were, asked itself so involuntarily, that there must needs have been an aptness in it. "What is to become of Priscilla?" Hollingsworth looked at me fiercely and with glowing eyes. He could not have shown any other kind of expression than that had he meant to strike me with a sword. "Why do you bring in the names of these women?" said he, after a moment of pregnant silence. "What have they to do with the proposal which I make you? I must have your answer. Will you devote yourself and sacrifice all to this great end and be my friend of friends forever?" "In heaven's name, Hollingsworth!" cried I, getting angry, and glad to be angry, because so only was it possible to oppose his tremendous concentrativeness and indomitable will. "Cannot you conceive that a man may wish well to the world and struggle for its good on some other plan than precisely that which you have laid down? And will you cast off a friend for no unworthiness but merely because he stands upon his right as an individual being and looks at matters through his own optics instead of yours?" "Be with me," said Hollingsworth, "or be against me. There is no third choice for you." "Take this, then, as my decision," I answered. "I doubt the wisdom of your scheme. Furthermore, I greatly fear that the methods by which you allow yourself to pursue it are such as cannot stand the scrutiny of an unblessed conscience." "And you will not join me?" "No." I never said the word, and certainly can never have it to say hereafter, that cost me 1,000th part so hard an effort as did that one syllable. The heart pang was not merely figurative, but an absolute torture of the breast. I was gazing steadfastly at Hollingsworth. It seemed to me that it struck him, too, like a bullet. A ghastly paleness, always so terrific on a swarthy face, overspread his features. There was a convulsive movement of his throat, as if he were forcing down some words that struggled and fought for utterance. Whatever words of anger or words of grief, I cannot tell, although many and many a time I have vainly tormented myself with conjecturing which of the two they were. One other appeal to my friendship, such as once already Hollingsworth had made, taking me in the revulsion that had followed a strenuous exercise of opposing will, would completely have subdued me. But he left the matter there. "Well," said he. And that was all. I should have been thankful for one word more, even had it shot me through the heart as mine did him. But he did not speak it, and after a few moments, with one accord, we set to work again, repairing the stone fence. Hollingsworth, I observed, wrought like a Titan, and for my own part, I lifted stones which, at this day or in a calmer mood at that one, I should no more have thought it possible to stir than carry off the gates of Gaza on my back. The end of chapter 15. Read by Rick Kistner for Lit2Go on the web at fcit.usf.edu.